6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight.
Good afternoon. This is A Public Affair with your host, Tanya Brito. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Peggy Weierman. She is the author of the recently published book entitled Connecting the Dots, Government, Community, and Family. Dr. Weierman is currently a freelance consultant in community and economic development. She holds a PhD in sociology, and she has lectured and consulted in 10 countries. She has extensive experience working as a legislative aide in Congress and in the executive branch in both Democratic and Republican administrations. Her previous books include Urban Neighborhoods, Networks, and Families, New Forms for Old Values, Partnerships for Prosperity, Museums, and Economic Development, and also Alice in Bushland, Fact and Fantasy in the Bush Administration. Dr. Weierman, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm absolutely delighted to be here. Thank you.
In your book, you lay out really a blueprint for presidential policies based on what you call real family values. And in the book, you take a position that neighborhoods today and our local communities exist in a broader context of a global economy, and that what happens in one city or neighborhood affects all of us around the nation and even around the globe. And you critique some of the approaches that we've been taking in policymaking in the past. So, for example, you take the position that individual and family self-reliance is certainly important, but it's not really enough to address the needs and the responsibilities of families, and that the other kinds of efforts that government calls upon, neighbors, community, nonprofits, churches, the business sector, also they play a role, but again, they're not enough. We need more, and that we actually need government involvement at the national level to address the many pressing issues that families confront. And so I guess I want to start with the example you provide in the book of how the country responded to the Hurricane Katrina disaster and used that as sort of a metaphor to illustrate these broader themes in your book. So can you elaborate a little bit on that for our listeners to give us a sense for your main sort of overall thesis?
Well, yes, thank you. I think I use the Katrina as a metaphor, not because we're talking about that kind of disaster, but because Americans too frequently can be hit by other kinds of disasters, as we're seeing right now in the mortgage crisis and financial crisis. And we looked at Katrina, and there were a couple of things. First of all, the levee failure was not unpredicted. It had been predicted. There had been recommendations to strengthen those levees under a number of years. The budgets for doing that had actually been cut by the Bush administration and just about 2 months before the levees actually broke. So that's the first thing. The second thing, that the plans for evacuation didn't include the fact that many people did not have cars. So they were based on an unrealistic assessment of what the families in Katrina actually looked like in terms of income and also in terms of age. Finally, the government response was inadequate and not good and not fast. Churches and volunteers were absolutely crucial. They are absolutely crucial to the way our neighborhoods work and our communities work, but they are not sufficient. We need national policies that push us in the right direction and monitor businesses so that they do the right things and provide the kinds of supplements that are necessary as well.
Now, you mentioned in the Hurricane Katrina example that one of the difficulties was incorrect assumptions about the kinds of families that were affected, believing that people had resources they didn't have, for example, a car. And you take the broader position in your book that a series of myths in the United States sort of persist in the face of concrete data tending to show what families are really like, and that the realities of how families are structured and how they behave are ignored in the face of a series of myths that seem to have, I don't know, a basis in partly history, but partly nostalgia. Can you talk about some of the myths that are pervading or underlying our policies about families that are interfering with more effective policymaking?
Yes. The first myth that I talk about is the Norman Rockwell myth of the two to parents and families. Right now, there are more households that are composed of single people than are composed of a family with two children. If you cut it down to a non-working wife, you're talking about 13% of the households. And yet our policies are based on this myth. If we seriously said this does not represent the American family or the American household, then what kinds of alternatives do we need? We would have to pay more attention to child care. We would have to pay more attention to after school care. We would have to pay more attention to flexibility in work. One of the other myths I talk about is I talk about the having it all myth. This is the glamorous woman who goes out to work and she has time for great relationships with her husband and takes good care of her children. The problem with this myth is that it isn't realistic for most working women. Most working women work in jobs where they do not have work flexibility and they do not make very large amounts of money. One of the reasons I think that there has been as much enthusiasm for Sarah Palin as there has been is the fact that she, in a sense, embodies this myth. She's going to have five children. She's going to be the governor, vice president, maybe even president, and she's having it all in this sense. The only question here is, however, most women, she and her husband have an income of, I think, over $120,000. Most working wives and mothers do not have this kind of income to have somebody else care for their children, send out for pizza.
Don't you think that part of the reason, at least that myth, some of the other myths are more perplexing to me, but for example, the myth of the woman who can do it all, work effectively, be successful in her job, be a good mother, be a good spouse or partner to her husband. It persists in part because of a desire on the part of many women to want to be in the workplace and not feel confined to the house. And so people feel uncomfortable even taking account of Sarah Palin's advantage financially. They feel uncomfortable calling into question her decision to be such a dedicated worker to the extent that she may in fact be sacrificing some of the responsibilities she has as a mother. Can you talk a little bit about that conflict that we experience?
Well, I think you're correct, but I think the question is, how do we support parents in parenting, given the workplace situation, given the fact that a large percentage of people work more than 40 hours a week, a large percentage of people travel, a large percentage of people who are on call. But if you're going to say, okay, working, I come from a generation in which actually it was the other problem, is that people wouldn't hire you because you might get married and have kids. So I'm very sympathetic to working women and working mothers. But the questions I haven't heard asked are, okay, it's great to have women working. What are we going to do to make sure we have adequate after-school care? What are we going to do to make sure that our workplaces are structured so that you can make a phone call home to your kids after school? What are we going to do to provide the kinds of public transportation so that if you can't afford a car, your kids can go someplace? So if you can't afford two cars, there's a way for your kids to get someplace by public transportation.
I guess I have basically kind of a two-part question. One is, why do you think these myths retain so much vitality in the face of competing empirical data? And maybe even more importantly, why do so many of our policymakers and politicians base their measures on information that is outdated? They certainly have access to information about the numbers of children in single-parent homes and the numbers of women who are in the workplace, and yet they're not responding to the needs that these families have.
Well, I think part of this is an ideological kind of a framework, so that if you come into from the position that government is bad, the private industry is good, then you don't really have a way of looking and saying, what about private industry works? which is clearly producing lots of good consumer goods? What about government works? So that if government expenditure is bad, then you're not in a position to buy the things that you might need to support working parents.
Okay. I'm going to remind our listeners that we're talking today with Dr. Peggy Weierman. She is the author of Connecting the Dots, Government, Community, and Family. She's joining us today to talk about her recently published book. Dr. Weierman, we were talking a little bit a while ago about these myths about families and how they influence policymaking. You talked a little bit about the political differences that many policymakers have about the approach they should take to issues that present themselves to families. I'm wondering, in terms of the American public, to the extent that they have mistaken beliefs about families, about individuals. You include a number of examples in your book, in addition to the Norman Rockwell myth, myths about people who receive public benefits. What can be done to disabuse the general public about these kinds of myths, so they're better informed and maybe they can challenge their policymakers more directly?
Well, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, quite frankly. That's one of the reasons. I think that you can listen to radio programs like this, which provide you good information. You can look at something on television on the weekends, that is, C-SPAN does. You go to the website and go to booktv.org, and there are 24 hours of interviews with nonfiction authors, and they range from the right and the left. I want to go back to one of the things you said about working mother women. It is true, women want to use their skills. Many of them want to be paid for using their skills. But it is also true that most women who work are either single parents or they contribute up to 35% of the income of the family. That if all of the women who worked simply to support their families quit tomorrow, the entire country would shut down.
So that they're an important part of the economy overall, but also just the survival of their families necessitates their involvement in the workforce.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The luxury of getting by on one wage is largely a relic of the past.
Yes. But that's because of deliberate shifts in business policies and government policies. The fact of the matter is if the income inequality, the way the basic structure is set up, was the same as under Ronald Reagan, 80% of the American families would have an additional $8,000 a year in income. Mm-hmm. That the there has been a vast shift between the working people and the top. That between 1995 and 2005, productivity went up by a third, but two-thirds of that money went to CEOs and to the stock market. Most Americans do not own a great deal of money in the stock market, even their 401ks, and even before the current mess. What they did own, many of them, was equity in their homes, which is being hurt by this mess, which was caused by the unregulated part of the mortgage market.
You make, an excellent point in your book about that dynamic you just explained. You ask the question, is it fair for the woman at the grocery checkout counter to subsidize the ski lodge of the owner of the grocery store chain? So with this increased productivity, there are increased profits, but that increased profit isn't being translated into higher wages for employees. And even the fairly modest increase in the minimum wage isn't going far enough for people to be able to support themselves and even a small family, even when they're working full-time today, if they're working at the minimum wage.
If you were working full-time today, in order to support a family of four, you would be having to make $40,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, most of the new jobs that are going to be created, growing the economy is a great idea, but most of the new jobs are not going to provide living wages. And unless there is interference from the government in terms of supporting labor unions and in terms of either raising the minimum wage further or in terms of increasing and expanding the earned income brings, people that we all depend upon cannot afford to live decently at what I would call a self-sufficiency standard.
I'm just going to remind people to call in at 256-2001. We are almost halfway through our show, and we need more callers to call in to support our station. The work we do here is very important, and listener contributions are our largest and most important source of funding for WORT. And this is the time of year that we turn to you. I know maybe some of you haven't called in yet with your donations. You're intending to do it later. Take a minute, stop. You can even make your donation online if that's more convenient for you. We can take those donations online using a credit card. Our website is www.wort-fm.org, or please call in to the station, 256-2001, our toll-free number, 1-866-899-WORT. We do have a goal for each program, and we aren't anywhere close to reaching our goal during this segment so far. So please do call in. Be the next person to call in. Oh, look, we have another donation now. We have a donation from Bill Whitford. He's in Madison. And thank you, Bill, very much for your donation. We appreciate you supporting the station. And please, others, keep up the momentum. Our phones are open. We have several volunteers who are waiting by to take your call. 256-2001. Dr. Weierman, we talked a little bit about families. You address also the private sector, government, religious institution, corporate entities, businesses, the media, and the role that they can play in addressing some of the issues confronting families. But you also take a look at some of the beliefs about these groups that are mistaken beliefs, that are impeding success on this front. For example, one is this idea of a preference for smaller government, or that government is inefficient, or that government isn't successful, and they keep doing it wrong. So why should we keep asking the government to intervene? You take a position that we actually need more government involvement, particularly at the federal level. Can you explain more about that?
Well, I think that there are two things that we need from the government. We need regulation of business, because business has fought all the rules for the environment, has fought labor unions, has fought higher wages. As a matter of fact, the Republicans in this state legislature right now are protesting about the potential increases of requirements for businesses in terms of mercury. There are 600,000 kids a year in this country who are born with potential health problems because of mercury. So you can count on businesses to oppose. They opposed mandatory requirements that you could take time off without getting fired if you had a baby or had to take care of a dying a parent. So that's the first thing we need. We need regulation of businesses. The second kind of thing is many federal programs do work. That the program, for example, to feed infants and pregnant women saves $3 for every one that's expended. But you can't fund these programs if you believe that federal programming is bad. For example, one of the things that was said last night by McCain, he said that he would freeze all government programs. The fact of the matter is, when you do this, you cut down the ability of states and localities to fund pick up costs that they're going to have when more people are unemployed and need food stamps, when more people lose their housing and need support in terms of finding some alternative homes. Every single neighborhood center in this city is run indirectly with federal funds.
Mm-hmm. The book also addresses the role of local entities in addressing some of these concerns that families have. And many people believe that local problems need to be addressed closer to home because it's the local actors who have a better sense for what the problems are and the kinds of solutions that might be useful. But you think that you take the position that localities have a role to play, but they can't go quite far enough. We still need some kind of involvement at the federal level because the problems are more widespread. Can you give an example of how this plays out in a particular policy area?
Well, I think it plays out in two situations. One thing it plays out in terms of rules, for example, the minimum wage. The minimum wage corrected for inflation was $10 an hour in 1968. It's now $7.75. This filters down and affects the whole local situation. The second thing is in terms of almost all the moderate income housing that has been built in this country for the last 20 years in localities has been built by nonprofit groups basically using federal money one way or another. So that is part of it. I'd like to go back just a minute
sure.
to the thing that I said about living decently. The self-sufficiency standard is what has been developed to show what it would cost to live without government help and without charity. It's about twice the poverty level.
Mm-hmm.
So we go back to the $40,000 for a family of four.
And in the poverty level itself is a controversial figure. I mean, many people have argued for a long time that it's set too low. And any one administration is reluctant to adjust it because immediately the numbers of people in poverty could, in fact, escalate, and that looks bad for them. So that many people believe that there are, in fact, more people living in poverty than the figures would reveal.
Well, the self-sufficiency standard is about twice the poverty level.
Mm-hmm.
It enables you to have a to rent someplace or to own it, you know, to live someplace, to have food, to have health care, to have child care, to have a car that you can use to go to work in, and for one shopping trip a week. It does not provide any money for entertainment, any money for savings, and it does not provide any meals outside the home. So that's what's twice the poverty level. The poverty level is based on a food budget that
mm-hmm.
you're not supposed to eat on a regular basis, and it assumes that housing costs have not gone up in the last 40
that's
years,
right.
Which of course we know they have.
That's right. It was set in about, 1958 or so?
No, it was set I think before that. I could
okay.
be mistaken about the date. But it was set on the assumption that food is a third of your budget.
Mm-hmm.
Housing is 50%
mm-hmm.
of many people's budgets.
Certainly.
So it's an unrealistic standard.
It's certainly outdated. We were talking a little while ago about the large sort of gap between minimum wage full-time earnings versus what people actually need in order to support themselves at a basic level that gives them some measure of dignity. I guess one question I have or one point I want to raise is that with the advent of welfare reform, which now we've had in place for over a decade, and so many people being basically, you know, sort of pushed off the rolls, there's been increasing attention to a group of people we call the working poor, these people who are working full-time and yet still are barely getting by and are very economically vulnerable. And that group doesn't carry quite as much stigma as the people who were on receiving government benefits in the past. So I guess one question I have is, why haven't there been more efforts made to address the needs of the working poor who are, you know, fulfilling their responsibilities of self-reliance and contributing to the economy, taking care of their families? Why are policymakers so reluctant to provide them with more assistance, whether it be income supports or increasing the minimum wage to a realistic level?
Well, I think it goes back to the feeling that if you're poor, it's your own fault. That's one feeling. I think the other feeling that is underlying that is a lot of these jobs are held by women. And there is some feeling in some quarters that women shouldn't be working anyhow. They should be in their homes. If these people quit tomorrow, these are people who do not make enough money to support three people at a poverty level. Waitresses and waitresses, maids, childcare workers, home health aides, retail salesperson, janitors and cleaners.
Mm-hmm.
If these people quit tomorrow, all of these people make poverty level wages, the country would shut down.
Okay. I just want to remind our listeners, we're talking to Dr. Peggy Wireman. She is the author of Connecting the Dots, Government, Community, and Family. She is here today talking with us about her recently published book. The book is available at Barnes & Noble, at Rainbow Bookstores. She'll be giving a talk on October 14th, that's next Tuesday, at 7 p.m. at Barnes & Noble on the west side at the Westtown Mall, and we encourage you to join her for that talk and book signing. I'm going to take a minute out to remind our listeners to call in with their donations. We need your support. We know you enjoy our station and what we have to offer here, but we do need your support to stay on the air. This is the time of the year where we come to you and ask you to make a commitment to us, a financial commitment, to help us do the important work that we do. So I hope you will be the next person to call in with your donation, no matter how small it might be. We know that not everyone can make a large donation, and that's just fine. Every dollar makes a difference in the quality of what you hear on WORT. The radio is not free. We cost a lot of money, not a lot relative to other stations, but for us, it's a lot of money because we are largely a volunteer-driven radio station, and we rely on our listeners to help us. Let me point out some of the premiums that we can offer you when you call in with your donation. At the $40 level, you can get a magazine subscription. We have two choices, Harper's Magazine, a one-year subscription, or the Progressive Magazine, also a one-year subscription. At the $50 level, we'll give you a copy of Dr. Wireman's book, Connecting the Dots, Building Strong Families, Strong Communities, and Terrific Neighborhoods. Or there are some other choices for books as well at that contribution level. The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, written by Naomi Wolf. And another book entitled Me Go Green, Greater Madison's Path to Living Green. It's a coupon book with all kinds of coupons that you can use to save at green-oriented businesses in Madison, including Willie Street Co-op, Trek Bicycle Store. And so those are all choices. Some other additional gifts that are available with your donation at the $50 level include the June Jordan Collection, a series of interviews made available by Pacifica, The Big Bang, 1968 Revolution Rewind, also from Pacifica Archives, Michael Fronte and Spearhead, All Rebel Rockers, and in addition to those, you can certainly avail yourself of the many WORT insignia items, including our mugs and T-shirts. Those are available at both the $50 and $80 level. Well, the T-shirts, very different types of T-shirts at different levels. So when you call in and you speak to one of our volunteers answering the phones, they'll give you more details about the various choices and at the levels that you would be making your donation. So please do call in. Again, the number is 256-2001. Our toll-free number, 1-866-899-WORT. Or you can make a donation online, www.wort-fm.org. And we do have another donation from Thomas Mitchell. He has made a donation, and thank you very much. He reports that his favorite shows include the Tuesday Buzz, the Saturday music programming during the 4 to 6 p.m. block, and also a public affair on Wednesday. So thank you very much, Thomas, for your donation. Again, the number is 256-2001. Our volunteers are sitting by the phone waiting for your phone call. We do need your assistance in helping us to keep our station on the air and bringing you the programming that you enjoy. Dr. Wireman, we were talking a little while ago about the role of government. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about some of the nonprofits that are involved as well in addressing the needs of the community, religious institutions, other kinds of organizations specifically designed to aid families and their needs. Can you explain what role they have to play? You've taken the position that they can't do everything, they can't solve all our problems. But what can we expect from them? In what way can they provide help?
I think that local community groups and local nonprofits are absolutely vital. I've done community organizing. I actually started off as a community organizer in South Chicago. I've worked in public housing communities. I was a halftime director for about a year and a half at the Allied Duns Marsh Neighborhood Center here in Madison. All of the efforts that I've ever been involved with, there were religious institutions that were absolutely crucial. But the problem, so that I think this is absolutely necessary. I think that they help bring communities together. They can fill gaps. They can identify needs. The Allied Nuns Marsh Neighborhood Center, for example, was actually developed when a Vista volunteer, which is a government program, but noticed that the kids needed a place to go after school. And the whole thing over a series of years kind of developed from that. I think that we had, among other things, we had a food pantry. But the problem is that, first of all, a lot of the food for those actually comes from the government. But the second thing is that they feed people, and it's absolutely necessary. Soup kitchens are helpful. They feed people. But the food stamps feed 26 million Americans every single month. So partly it's a question of scale, and partly it's a question of dignity. The other thing is that if the nonprofits weren't scrambling around trying to figure out how to help people get basic housing and basic food, they could address the issues that I think really could be where their energies might be really best used, in creating celebrations, in doing one-to-one tutoring with kids. Flubbing on the name, but the United Church Groups are doing prisoner reentry programs where churches really work one-to-one basis with a prisoner coming back. They could sponsor questions and have discussions on race relations. These are things that they're uniquely qualified to do, but it's hard for them to cough up the times of time and energy and one-to-one involvement that is necessary when they're scrambling around just trying to take care of how do you handle the person that got evicted from their house because they didn't have the money to pay the rent last week.
Or doing their own fundraising just to stay in existence.
Yes.
Because they're often operating on a shoestring budget themselves.
They are most nonprofits. First of all, many nonprofits are not really local. They're branches of national organizations which have big budgets and so forth and so on. Most nonprofits have at the most 5 employees, and they're operating on very small budgets.
Mm-hmm. And also very vulnerable to the market conditions as well.
Yes, and they're doing fundraising all the time, and they're spending their time fundraising as opposed to doing what they're uniquely qualified to do.
You talked a little bit a while ago about community building, and you include in your book sort of a prescription for how to address that. Can you give us an overview of that approach that you recommend for community building? Because it's an important part of this larger puzzle. Your book basically puts all these pieces together, family, community, business, government, and talk about how they all serve a purpose. But the question about community is a little bit elusive because communities have changed over the years, but we still expect the community to play a role.
Well, one of the things about community in terms of how you build communities, one of the things that I feel is very important is having public spaces where you can have community meetings, you can sponsor courses that are actually designed by local community people, and it's a neutral place where people can meet. I think this is very, very important.
Thanks.
It's particularly important when you have differences in income, ethnicity, or race.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing you can do.
Okay. We have another donation that's been brought in. Our donor is Aaron. Aaron, thank you so much for calling in with your donation. We appreciate your help. Aaron is in Madison, and she wrote that she just loves Ward, both as a listener and as a volunteer. Thank you so much, Aaron. Her 3 favorite shows are Public Affair, Backyard, In Our Backyard, and BBC News, also Psychoacoustics. So thank you again, Aaron, for calling in with your donation. I hope other listeners will follow Aaron's lead and also call in, be the next to call. Our volunteers are waiting at the phones. We know that you are listening to this show. Probably many of you stay on the line, and listen to Amy Goodman after this show is over. I know I do every day listen to Amy Goodman. I learned so much from that show. Many of these programs that aren't locally produced, we do have to sometimes pay for those shows, and that costs us money. And we hope that you will give a call so you can help us continue to provide that programming to you. The number here is 256-2001. And the phone number, toll-free number, 1-866-899-WORT, or make your donation online, www.wort-fm.org. We do appreciate any support you can provide, even if it's just $5 or $10. Every dollar helps, and we know that our listeners have a variety of different economic levels, and so please don't hesitate, even if your donation is a modest one. We do appreciate any donation that you can make. We have another donation also to announce on the air. Robert Beatty, he is a Madison resident, and he has also made a donation, so we want to thank Robert for his donation as well. Okay, so before we finish up, Dr. Weirman, I thought we were going to, I guess, jump ahead a little bit and talk about some of the recommendations you make, the approach you recommend for how government should reorient itself, really, to address the problems that families are facing and the lack of support they're currently receiving. And here you present, again, you'd call them four propositions which form the basis for a more realistic approach to establishing a common national vision. Can you tell us about those four propositions?
Yes. One proposition is that everybody who works full-time ought to receive a living wage, which means it would support at least a couple of people at a self-sufficiency level. The second proposition is that if businesses can't afford to do this, and they used to do it, but they no longer wish to or feel they can't afford to do it, then the government needs to step in either by raising and expanding the earned income tax so it subsidizes the businesses that are not paying decent wages, or through some kind of alternative programs. The next thing is we need universal health care. And universal health care that includes treatment for mental illnesses, that includes alcohol and drug treatment. It's really very interesting. My concern with getting health care on the private market, it isn't that we need a government system. We don't need a government system, but we do need universal health care, and we do need some government guidelines. For example, I don't believe that the Palin family could buy health insurance on the private market, because if you try and get individual families try and get health insurance on the private market, they won't find an insurance company that will insure a family with a Down's child. So we do need universal health care. And finally, we need high quality child care. That if we invested in high quality child care for every 3- and 4-year-old in this country, it would pay for itself by year 6, and we would save billions of dollars over the long term. So those are my four suggestions.
I want to probe a little more with that, but we do have a caller who's waiting to join our conversation, so I'll let them speak now. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
I had two comments.
Sure.
One is Senator Russ Feingold from Wisconsin tried to get campaign finance reformed. John McCain sort of rode on his coattails, although it wasn't his idea. And, of course, it was huge, huge opposition from corporations. But I remember women's liberation activities in the 1970s. And women asked for equal pay for equal work. And corporate America's response was to lower men's wages and to work on getting foreign workers who would work for less money to do the work American workers had done, so that everybody's wages were lowered instead of having women's wages raised to the average level of men's wages. And our political system is really, as we can see from the crisis that's engulfing the finance industry over the world these days, and it basically allows huge corporations and people with obscene amounts of money to bribe legislators and executives at all levels of government until they're allowed to write laws that destroy everybody else, destroy the social fabric, and transfer all that money into their own pockets for doing nothing. And I'd be interested in hearing your comments, because I think until we get rid of this system of legalized bribery, I don't think we're going to make any progress. We need a progressive taxation system in this country, because we've got now taxation without representation.
Thank you for joining us.
I don't know how to tell you how to reform the entire financial and political system in the next 30 seconds. I will say this. There is an election coming up, and elections do make a difference. Both politicians are not perfect. Politicians have to make compromises. But by and large, politicians, in fact, can, in fact, make changes in the systems. And that is the only way the system is actually going to be changed. So I agree with many of your comments, and I wish us all luck.
Can you give us a sense for how the position of the presidential candidates compares with the blueprint you've outlined? Do you feel like either candidate is addressing the issues you raised in the way that you advocate?
Well, yes. I think throughout his career, McCain has basically called for deregulation. It was deregulation of the mortgage market that got us into this current mess, including changes made at the suggestions of one of his chief economic advisors. His solution is to continue the Bush tax cuts, which go to the very wealthy, to add some tax cuts for the very wealthy, and to cut programs that would help finance things like food stamps and low-income housing. There are millions of Americans who are paying 50% of their income in housing. And this mortgage crisis is not just affecting homeowners. It's also affecting renters who are losing their homes. But the programs, for example, housing vouchers that would help them get alternative housing would be cut.
Okay. And what about Senator Obama? How does his proposal or his sort of platform align with some of the positions you've taken?
Well, there are two things. One thing, his tax cuts go to people making under $250,000 a year. For example, seniors making less than 50 would pay no income taxes. So that's the first thing. The second thing is he has said that he will invest in some things, like he wants to put more money in child care. And what I was telling you a few minutes ago is that if we put money into just the 3 and 4 year olds, high quality child care, by 2050, we would be saving almost $800 billion a year. This is a lot of money. It would pay for a lot of things.
And how does that $800 billion figure, did you say billion or million?
Billion.
Okay. How do we get to that figure? I mean, where are the savings?
Well, you get
from?
Savings if you do invest in high quality child care. You save money through special education needs for when the kids hit school. You mm-hmm. save money for delinquency. You can buy high-quality child care for about 10% of what it costs to keep a kid in prison for a year.
Okay.
So that's how you pay for it. The other thing that I would like to say is I think Obama, by his just running, has changed a number of the conversations in this nation. One of the questions I think nobody in this country has grown up without being affected by the various racial conversations that float around in the country.
And you do take up the question of race in your book quite explicitly.
That's right. And so that the question is for every individual of both races, of all races, how have I personally been affected by those conversations? And what do we do as a nation to move beyond them?
It's often very hard for people to ask those questions or to acknowledge the existence of race-based, you know, views, because it's often unconscious.
Well, also, there's a difference between I have a race-based view and therefore I'm a racist, and saying, gee, I remember when my mother said X. Oh, well, do I still believe X?
Mm-hmm. We have a caller who's waiting to join our conversation, so I'll turn to them now. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing? I think what Peggy is saying is very interesting, but I'm going to bring up a point that I always find it necessary to bring up because people are still afraid to touch it, and that's that the real conversation deals not with race but class, and class is the critical issue. Peggy is correct that somebody needs to do something to ensure that the value of individuals' labor is enough to provide at least minimal subsistence, which is not the case right now. Then my other comment about health insurance, unfortunately, I think that's going to be something that the government will have to be providing. I know that I don't believe that private insurance companies will do that. I used to work for an insurance company, so I know firsthand how ugly the environment is within the insurance industry, and the emphasis is entirely upon profit maximization, even when the companies are operating on a profitable basis. So there's going to be a need for much more government action as far as providing universal health. But the crucial point, though, is that we have to look at things in terms not of race, but in terms of class, because that's the key to the problem. And I'll just take my comments off the air. And thanks for taking the call.
Thank you for calling in.
I'd like to respond to that. First of all, I think your comments are very well apt, but it is not a question of either race or class. It is a question of both and. Unfortunately, every single study that has been done on racial discrimination indicates that it is, in fact, alive and well. And sometimes it's very subtle. For example, when somebody goes to apply for a job and the person interviewing them doesn't tell them about other higher job applications that they could go. They've done studies, for example, in the housing market, which I'm most familiar with.
With all the testers.
Where you have two people, and this has happened even in Madison, you have two people go in and apply for the same house or the same rental property, and the discrimination is about 25%, as I recall, where the white person is shown a house and the black person is not shown a house, or the black person is not shown a house and the white person is shown the same house 5 minutes later. So, and the subprime mortgage market, one, it was, in fact, they did, in fact, target low-income minority areas, 30% of whom actually qualified for fixed mortgages and were not offered them. And then the other thing is that they get blamed. There's a lot of discussion going on, and some of it is overt and some of it is subtle, saying it was the low-income people, i.e. minorities, that caused all of this. It wasn't. It was the unscrupulous realtors and unscrupulous who got people involved in the mortgages and sold them to them and made a fortune. It's the mortgage companies who didn't bother to read the documentation or lack of it who had been given it. It was not the people at the lower end, some of whom perhaps made poor judgments.
We've been talking with Dr. Peggy Weierman. She is the author of Connecting the Dots, Government, Community, and Family. We thank her very much for joining us this hour.